Chapter 23. If my own metamorphosis from lepidopterist to princess had been dramatic, Stoker's was scarcely less impressive. I emerged from the bedchamber to find him standing at the hearth, posture erect, costumed in the full dress uniform of the Alpenwalder Guard of Honour. The livery was black, piped with brilliant alpine blue. The trousers had been changed in favour of knee breeches with white stockings, displaying the splendour of his calves as effectively as the tight coat paid compliment to the breadth of his shoulders and the slimness of his waist. The shako had been replaced by a soft cap of black velvet, with a long blue plume secured with a jewelled pin. A wide riband of blue and white crossed his chest, and a black silk patch was secured over his eye. Spotless white gloves completed the ensemble. He had been speaking to the Chancellor when I entered, but when he caught sight of me, he stopped, and for a moment we were the only two people in the room, perhaps even on earth. I paused and he advanced, bowing low as he swept off the cap. I realized then that he wore a short velvet cape that swung as he moved, with a sort of Elizabethan swagger. "Most effective," I murmured.
"Dazzling," he said, brushing his mouth over my fingers. "Yes, if you don't mind, I think we really could get on,"
said Maximilian, not troubling to conceal his peevishness. He was wearing a costume nearly identical to Stoker's, only trimmed with quantities of silver braid. The garments suited him, but when compared to Stoker, he seemed a penciled copy of an oil painting, and I did not begrudge him his sulkiness. He was accustomed to being accounted one of the handsomest men in the Alpenwald, and now he had competition. I smiled at him as graciously as I could as I took his arm. In strict accordance with protocol, I was accompanied by the Duke, while the Chancellor escorted the Baroness. Stoker and JJ, pressed into service for the evening and now changed into a stark and pristine uniform of white and black, brought up the rear. As we made our way down to the lobby, the Chancellor explained the arrangements for the evening.
"We will leave from the back entrance," he said, directing Maximilian. "It is not precisely a secret where we are bound, but neither is it publicized. Discretion is key," he stressed. "Our hosts have sent a pair of private carriages, and we will travel by these conveyances instead of by train."
The waiting carriages bore no crest or distinguishing marks, but it was apparent that the owner was a person of immense wealth. Every detail was of the highest quality, from the tufted silk of the squabs to the delicate Tudor rose motif on the glass panes of the lamps. The first was just large enough to admit the four of us, the Baroness, Chancellor, Duke, and I, once my train had been folded carefully around me. The Baroness and I travelled facing forward with the Duke, while the Chancellor took the centre of the opposite seat. Stoker and JJ were relegated to the second carriage, as befitted their station for the night. The night was clear and cold, and the journey took much longer than expected as we bowled briskly away, through the city and into the dark countryside of Berkshire. My aunts and I had moved often during my childhood, exchanging one country village for another very like it, all in a bid to avoid those who might seek out the Prince of Wales's semi-legitimate child. I had neither known nor appreciated their reasons for uprooting my tender self at the time. Instead, it had been an endless round of beginnings and partings. Most of the hamlets I had forgot, but one stayed fresh in my memory, a tiny settlement in the shadows of Windsor Castle, just beyond the meadows of Runnymede. I remembered the broad fields, lushly green and dotted with the fleecy clouds of sheep grazing on the spring grass. I had fallen from an apple tree there and broken my arm, I recalled. That was when I had received my first butterfly net as a gift from the aunts for my birthday. Enchanted, I had taken it on a long walk, netting my first specimen in the ring net now long replaced by a professional's. But I had loved that net, loved the feeling of the wind in my hair and the earth under my feet. It was in those meadows, chasing the lazy flap of a lepidopteron, that I had learnt my trade. And one afternoon, late in the autumn of my 12th year, I wandered further than usual in pursuit of Cyaniris semiargus, the Mazarine blue, a pretty little palearctic butterfly. I hopped over streams and scrambled over stiles as the afternoon drew to a close. The butterfly, a male with delectably blue coloration, eluded me, lifting itself on gossamer wings to freedom. Dejected, I stood for a long moment, collecting my whereabouts. And there it was, just ahead on the horizon, Windsor Castle. I stared up at the castle, the proud stone enormity of it rising above the landscape like something out of myth. The afternoon light lay softly upon it, gilding the cold grey battlements to a glimmering sheen that would have suited King Arthur himself. It was the most glorious thing I had ever seen, and I stood, rooted to the spot like a meadow flower, wondering about the princes and princesses who sheltered within its walls. I knew our queen was Victoria, and that she lived there, wrapped in widow's weeds. Her children must have been largely grown by then, but I imagined them still in the nursery, dressed in sailor suits and lawn dresses, attending their lessons and eating milk and bread from porringers marked with a crown. Oh, how I envied them. Not their royalty, I realized with a pang. I envied them each other. I envied the sense of belonging to a family with more brothers and sisters almost than one could count, of knowing a mother's touch, of a home that stood, resolute and unchanging in the mellow autumn gold of that afternoon. Little did I realize that I had almost as good a claim upon the place as those who dwelt within its walls, I thought, as the carriages bore us out of London into the west. Such were my thoughts, and I was aware of a rising excitement, not at visiting a castle, but at setting foot in what was my family home. My ancestors had built the place, stone by stone, and had lived there, had died there, loved and hated and born new generations within its walls, and at last I would come home. So lost in my own reflections was I, that I did not realize we had reached Windsor until the castle loomed above us in all of its grey majesty, and I felt a sudden thrust of longing for Stoker. I had told him once, as we lay curled together in the dark, of my memory of the place, of the wrench I felt that afternoon when I returned home to find the aunts had packed us up and were moving us on once more. I never saw the castle again except in memory, and each time I embellished it more, raising the towers a little higher, the battlements a little wider. I fashioned of it a fairy castle, and I had confided in Stoker that the frisson of feeling that day in the water meadow had been unlike anything I had experienced before or since. Long after discovering my father's identity, I recalled that day, and I marveled at my experience, wondering if somehow the memory of my ancestors, deep in my bones and blood, had stirred at the home they had built. It was the sort of thing one could only speak of in the dark, fast in a lover's arms, safe in the shelter of his kindness. He had not ridiculed me. There had not been even a hint of a smile in his voice, only his broad, capable hands, gently stroking my hair as I talked. He would understand what coming to Windsor meant to me. And there it was, just as I had remembered. Only now it stood against the purple velvet of a winter sky, the windows glowing with lamplight. A river mist had risen, curling softly about the foundation stones of the castle, causing it to look as if it were floating on a cloud. No mere mortals dwell here, it seemed to say. This is a place of grandeur, of royalty, of 1,000 years of power. And who are you to dare to come inside? I shivered, and the Baroness gave me a concerned look.
Are you cold, my dear?
I am fine, I told her in a hollow voice. I had a moment to collect myself as the carriage passed under the great gate and drew to a halt in the courtyard. The castle's footman came forward to help us alight as the driver steadied the horses. The Chancellor and Maximilian, nearest the door, made their exit first. The Baroness followed, and I was surprised to find that Stoker had already alighted from his carriage and stood ready to hand me from mine. He paused, giving me just a moment to gather my courage.
It is time,
he said softly. I rested my hand in his, fixing my gaze upon him, my only anchor in an uncertain world at that moment. He squeezed my hand, so tightly I felt the bones ache, and I clasped his hand in return as I descended in lieu of the words I could not say aloud. Behind me, the Baroness and JJ gathered my train in their arms, holding it aloft until I moved up the broad stone steps, a river of scarlet carpet flowing down the centre. The footmen stood at attention, the buttons of their livery sparking in the torchlight. Maximilian stepped forward, and I relinquished my hold on Stoker, leaving my hand on his as long as I dared.
Ready, Poppet?
Maximilian asked, baring his teeth in a smile. I put my hand on his arm and felt the Baroness and JJ lower the train, unfurling it behind me. The weight of it dictated that I move slowly, in a stately walk, very unlike my usual energetic gait. At the top of the steps, an official of some sort in a dignified uniform waited for us, bowing respectfully.
Your Serene Highness,
he pronounced,
welcome to Windsor Castle. This way, if you please.
I accepted his greeting with a grave inclination of the head, and Maximilian and I followed as he led the way into the castle proper. A housekeeper came forward to collect JJ, and she gave me a little nod as she followed. I had kept my part of the bargain and got her into the castle. What she did with the opportunity was up to her. I turned my attention to the dignitary, who was keeping up a courteous patter as he escorted us.
Each of our foreign guests has been assigned an English host, a way of making the visit a more cordial and personal one,
he explained.
Your host is waiting here. The others have all arrived, so once you have been introduced, we will proceed directly into dinner.
We approached a door, heavy oak carved thickly with the motif of oak leaves, and the footman standing outside threw it open. The room was smaller than I expected, a sort of anteroom, I supposed, furnished in serviceable but not grand style. Across the room was a bank of windows, the curtains drawn against the chilly night. A fire burned merrily on the hearth, and in front of it, warming himself, stood a distinguished Englishman in formal evening dress. He turned, a smile of welcome on his lips. The smile faltered only slightly as the official made the introduction.
Your Serene Highness, may I present your escort for the evening, Sir Rupert Templeton Vane?
Sir Rupert, Her Serene Highness, the Hereditary Princess of the Alpenwald.
If my heart had stilled at the sight of the castle, that was nothing compared to the reaction when I came face to face with Stoker's elder brother. Sir Rupert, the second of the Templeton Vane brothers, had upon occasion come to our aid. He was the most conventional of the siblings, preferring a life of rectitude and regularity to the flamboyant extravagances of the eldest, Tiberius, or the cheerful mischief of the youngest, Merryweather. The fact that he and Stoker seldom saw eye to eye was no great mystery. They were as alike as chalk and cheese, they claimed. And yet, from time to time, I caught a glimpse of the daring and dash that ran like wildfire through the Templeton veins behind the facade of correctness. From behind me, I heard Stoker's muffled curse, and I went forward, extending my hand to Rupert. "How do you do, Sir Rupert?" Rupert bowed over my hand, pressing his lips to the gloved fingers.
"How do you do, Your Serene Highness?"
Without rising, he lifted his dark gaze to mine. I gave an imperceptible shake of the head and he straightened.
"May I present the rest of my entourage?"
I said, launching into introductions. Maximilian looked bored, whilst the Baroness and Chancellor were polite.
"How very kind of you to welcome us,"
I said, infusing my words with a trace of a German accent.
"Not at all, madam. There are few things in life I enjoy more than a partner at dinner whose conversation is certain to entertain,"
he said, his mouth twitching. The castle usher made a discreet gesture, and Rupert extended his arm.
"Shall we go in?"
I accepted his arm, and he covered my hand with his own, pressing tightly.
"How happy I am to further the cause of Anglo-Alpenwalder relations," he said loudly.
I smiled at him, and he dropped his voice.
"What in the name of seven hells is going on?"
he asked in a harsh whisper, still smiling as we made our way into the corridor.
"You sound just like your brother,"
I whispered back.
"Miss Speedwell,"
he began.
"The last time we met, you called me Veronica, and you said I could call you Rupert," I reminded him.
"I was rather influenced by that diabolical drink you gave me,"
he retorted.
"Aguardiente," I said. "I regret I do not have my flask upon my person at present. This ensemble does not permit such appurtenances."
"Veronica,"
he said, tightening his grip.
"We have perhaps 30 seconds before we reach the dining room, where 24 dignitaries and officials are waiting to eat dinner with you and then sign a peace treaty binding two countries in perpetual friendship, a treaty upon which I have laboured for the better part of a year and for which I am to receive advancement. Please tell me that you are not intending to bring me to ruination by somehow contriving to destroy this."
"Certainly not," I assured him.
"Then would you please explain why else you are here, if not to jettison my career?"
"I did not even know you were involved,"
I protested. "Stoker never told me you had a post in the Foreign Office."
"I do not, as it happens. My role is a more personal one in Her Majesty's household,"
he explained.
"I am a sort of liaison. It is my task to bring together those who would not ordinarily work in tandem to accomplish goals set by the Queen and her closest advisers."
"Against the will of the government?"
I asked.
"Of course not."
He sounded appalled at the very idea.
"But sometimes what the government wants is for matters to be handled discreetly. In this case, it would be far too complicated to broker this treaty publicly and offend the German Empire, and it would no doubt make the Empress's position even more difficult than it already is.
I will not fail you, I promised. Your treaty will be signed.
It will hardly be legal if it is signed by Veronica Speedwell, spinster of the Marylebone Parish, he muttered.
It is not like you to be rude, I told him in a soothing tone. I fear you are hungry, and it is making you dyspeptic.
I am not hungry. I am having an apoplexy, he said,
taking out a handkerchief and dabbing at his brow. I peered at his face.
You do look rather florid. Would you like to take a moment?
I asked kindly. He stopped before a tall pair of double doors.
There is no time, he told me,
fixing a thoroughly unconvincing smile upon his lips.
We are here.
Chapter 24. Much of the evening passed as if in a dream. I was seated between Sir Rupert and the French delegate, who bowed deeply and kissed both of my hands when he was presented.
General de Letellier, Rupert murmured. The general is the French signatory to the treaty.
The general swept me a bow, clasping my outstretched hand.
Your Serene Highness,
he murmured against my gloves, and it felt as much like a seduction as a greeting. He was at least 30 years my senior, with a tightly girdled waist and hair pomaded thickly against his head, but what he lacked in personal charms he more than compensated for in gallantry.
The English are very casual, he remarked. We ought to have been introduced in the anteroom, but I must not care about etiquette when it means I have the company of such a lady all to myself.
He stepped sharply in front of the castle footman to push in my chair with his own hands, taking the opportunity to glance swiftly down my décolletage.
Merveilleux,
he murmured.
I beg your pardon, I said, widening my eyes at him.
I reflected then that my ordinary instincts in such situations could not be reliably called upon. I had often been complimented, inveigled, caressed, and otherwise importuned in my travels, and it was my experience that a few sharp minuten, tiny pins meant to fix a butterfly to a card, when judiciously applied to an offender's person, invariably rendered him apologetic. But that would hardly do in this case. To begin with, I risked causing grave insult to the other signatory of the treaty. Beyond that, there was every possibility that he would object strenuously to being stabbed. Men, as it happens, were often not enthused about such a development, I had observed.
I was marveling at the generosity of the good God,
he told me as he took his seat.
To make a woman royal is a gift from the Almighty. To make her beautiful as well, that is an abundance of favour.
Is there a Madame de Letellier? I asked pointedly.
He nodded towards a lushly curvaceous brunette, dressed in rose-pink taffeta and leaning very close to Stoker, her mouth curved into a smile.
That is Honorine, he said. I will not introduce you, for you will not like her, as the women never do. But the men...
He raised his eyes heavenwards and made an ecstatic sound in the back of his throat. Madame de Letellier was a few decades younger than her husband, and I could well imagine how she had come to his notice. I said nothing, but inclined my head a fraction, just enough to set the jewels on my tiara trembling as I reached for my menu card. Inscribed in elegant French, it detailed the courses we were about to receive. I conversed politely with de Letellier for the first course, a clear consommé.
Is this your first trip to England, madame?
The general inquired as we sipped. I took a spoonful of soup to delay answering. The longer it took me to reply to his queries, the fewer of them he could pose, I reasoned. And that meant not quite as many opportunities for me to stumble in my masquerade. I sidestepped the question and posed one of my own. England is a charming place, I think, I said slowly. What do you make of it? The general launched into a lengthy speech about his host country, whilst I applied myself to my soup, occasionally offering a wide-eyed nod of agreement to encourage his monologue. Most men loved nothing better than holding forth on their opinions, and the general was no exception. He detailed his thoughts on the weather, appalling, the landscape, passably pretty, the politics, incomprehensible to outsiders, and the handsomeness of the women, lacking. I nearly bristled at the last until I realized I was not, for the purposes of the evening, supposed to be an Englishwoman.
But,
he added, as I spooned up the last of my consommé,
there is an idealism about the English which I find irresistible. We French are pragmatic. We see things as they are. But John Bull, the typical Englishman, he sees things as he wishes them to be. Like children, they play at being empire builders, wanting all the world to drink tea and keep the stiff upper lip. But it can never succeed.
I looked at him in surprise. The general was rather more perceptive than I had realized.
You do not believe in empires?
His smile was rueful and deeply attractive.
My dear madame, one cannot build an empire without paying for it, and the cost is always too high, as France learned to her sorrow. Ask them all, Alexander, Caesar, Napoleon. They were authors of empires, and what did it profit them? They died as all men must, and their empires crumbled to dust.
He waved his hands.
No, madame, the game of empires is one that cannot be won. That is why I am here tonight.
We have that in common, I told him. I believe in self-determination, that all peoples have a right to be left to govern themselves as they see fit. He raised an eyebrow in surprise.
Surely only if they have the education to do so under democratic principles,
he stated.
You would see the gospel of Montesquieu preached throughout the world,
I teased.
All men must be schooled to take their destiny in their hands,
he said gravely. I glanced across the table and saw Stoker laughing at some witticism of Madame de Letellier.
And what of the women?
I challenged her husband. Should they have no role in shaping the future of their countries? The general took a long sip of his wine.
Ladies do not always have the capacity for understanding matters of governance, excepting yourself, of course,
he added with a gallant little bow.
All the more reason to educate them as well, I told him.
I pointed to the centerpiece then, a lavish silver epergne stuffed with hothouse roses and lilies and St. Otild's wort, a floral compliment to the nations represented around the table. Atop the flowers, in a display of symbolism that entirely escaped me, perched a pair of stuffed birds with bright plumage. "Eclectus roratus cornelia," I told the general. "The Sumba Island Eclectus parrot. You see how one is pale green and the other a brilliant scarlet?" He nodded.
"Of course, the male is so dominant and attractive."
"That is not the male," I corrected. "The male Eclectus is green, the color of his surroundings, meant to blend in and go unnoticed. It is the female which boasts the glorious scarlet plumage. You, my dear general, have made the very common mistake of believing, as so many others do, that the male of the species is the default. I would like to refer you to Antoinette Brown Blackwell, whose very excellent work, The Sexes Throughout Nature, corrects this error on the part of Mr. Darwin." I broke off at the expression of bemusement on his face. Too late, I realized that Gisela might converse knowledgeably about stamps or cheese, perhaps even politics, but she most assuredly would not lecture on the subject of natural history. Luckily for me, the general was more attentive to my face than my topic of conversation.
"How stern you look," he said, "that I have caused such a lovely face to look so forbidding. I will never forgive myself."
A sharp retort rose to my lips, but I felt a quick pinch from my other side. Rupert was still talking in a desultory fashion with an elderly Frenchwoman, something about porcelain, but his hand had slipped under the table to nip me hard upon the leg.
"Madame, you are quite well? Only you look pained,"
the general said, his expression one of grave concern.
"I am quite well," I assured him. "Just a passing discomfort."
He leaned near, lowering his voice conspiratorially.
"It is the English food. My liver has complained since I crossed the channel. Nothing but beefsteaks and potatoes. So many potatoes,"
he mourned.
"I recommend a strong tisane of peppermint. It always soothes the stomach."
I thanked him politely, and just then the consommé bowls were taken away and the next course laid. I turned to find Rupert staring daggers at me.
"Is it absolutely necessary to spout radical philosophy at the general?"
he demanded in a whisper.
"It is hardly radical to propose that women have a say in government," I told him.
"It is to anyone sitting at this table. And evolutionary theory? I hardly think the Princess of the Alpenwald has even heard of Mr. Darwin, much less is conversant with his detractors."
"Antoinette Brown Blackwell is not precisely a detractor."
I broke off as Rupert began to glower at me.
"You are doing it again,"
he said tightly.
"I think my conversation amuses the general,"
I said, lifting my fork.
"Do not worry about amusing him,"
Rupert said as he stabbed his woodcock.
"Your only concern is getting through this horror of an evening without anyone becoming the wiser as to who you are."
I gave him a demure look that I hoped would signal my agreeableness. But he ignored me, eating his way stolidly through the course until the plates were changed.
"You will give yourself indigestion if you carry on this way," I advised Rupert as I turned back to the general.
The Frenchman was staring at his new plate mournfully. Slices of rosy beef were arranged artfully with piped pureed potatoes.
"You see, beefsteaks and potatoes,"
he lamented. I pointed to the menu. "Roast beef et pomme dauphine." He shrugged.
"You may call it by a pretty name, but it is still the food of the British peasant."
He poked at the meat with his knife.
"This steak is overcooked. It grieves upon my plate."
The slices of beef were pink and succulent-looking, but every Frenchman I had ever known preferred his beef very nearly still on the hoof. I signalled to the footman behind me, who sprang to attention.
"Your Serene Highness?"
"I am afraid the General cannot eat his steak. Kindly bring him one that is much less thoroughly cooked, and a salad, lightly dressed with oil and vinegar." The footman whisked the offending plate away, and the General gave a little crow of delight. He leaned towards me, his voice a caressing whisper.
"You know, I say to myself, Achille, how can this lovely creature, so natural, so unspoilt, be a princess? I begin to doubt that you are the princess,"
he said, smiling broadly.
"Perhaps you are the fairy changeling."
A frisson of terror surged down my spine, icy as a chilblained finger. "Oh?" I said faintly.
"But then, to see you command this fellow so expertly, I know you are a woman accustomed to giving the orders."
He regarded me with a practiced gleam in his eye.
"Now, I must mourn that you are a princess so far out of reach,"
he murmured. His gaze dropped lazily to my décolletage again, and then rose, unwillingly, it seemed, back to my face.
"I think I will write poetry to you."
"I beg you will not trouble yourself," I told him.
"What is trouble when there is such beauty in the world?"
he demanded. He launched into a lengthy poem in French, only half of which I understood, larded as it was with vernacular terms and metaphors that I suspected were slightly indecent. As the footman refilled his glass, I realized he had taken a great deal of the wine and had as yet consumed very little of the food. He raised his glass to the light, studying the color.
"Do you know, madame, there are those who say you should only taste wine from a goblet made of black glass, so that the eye may not be fooled by the color, that only the senses of the nose and the tongue are to be trusted. But what a loss! See this beautiful color, like the velvet of my first mistress's favorite gown, and the bouquet!"
He inserted his nose deeply into the glass, sniffing hard.
"Such heavy fruits, cherries and the red currant, so subtle and ripe. This is a very good wine, a wine so good one may dine upon it."
That seemed what he was inclined to do. He finished two more glasses before his food arrived, and when it did, he stared at his fork as if slightly confused by it. I exchanged my plate with his and cut his meat swiftly into little pieces before handing it back. "Eat," I ordered.
"I am yours to command,"
he said, with limpid eyes. He had eaten half the steak by the time the plates were cleared, and there was a brief struggle as the footman removed his. The general clung to it, grumbling as he snatched another piece of steak. The next course after the roasts was a lovely entremet of artichoke with a parsleyed white wine sauce. The general ignored his entirely in favour of picking desultorily at a jellied orange until the pudding course was served. He brightened at the fanciful display of Pudding Saxe Weimar, a chocolate pudding lavishly embellished with cream and butter biscuits. He took a spoonful, rolling his eyes ecstatically in pleasure and making rather unseemly noises of appreciation. The footman had attempted to take his glass of Bordeaux and pour the dessert wine, but the general would not hear of it, holding it up protectively out of reach and snapping his teeth at the hapless servants.
"What the devil is happening over there?"
Rupert demanded. "The general is most appreciative of the vintage served with the meat," I told him. Rupert edged back in his chair and peered around me discreetly.
"He is drunk as a lord,"
he pronounced in obvious disgust.
"All the better," I whispered. "It means he is less likely to notice any imposture on my part."
The tablecloth moved as the general's hand crept near, landing on my thigh. Rupert glanced down, reddening.
"This cannot stand,"
he began, half rising.
"It is bad enough the man insisted on red wine being served during a course with artichokes, but this is quite too far."
I clamped my hand over Rupert's to stay him, careful to keep a smile on my lips in case we were observed. "I have the matter in hand, I assure you, Rupert. I have dealt with far more importunate men upon my travels. Leave it to me and eat your pudding." He subsided in his chair and applied himself to the sweet. The general's hand crept higher, caressing the heavy satin draped over my thigh. Casually, I reached for my salt cellar, heaping the tiny spoon full. "General," I said suddenly, nodding towards the wall to his right, "is that painting French? I think it must be a Delacroix." The painting in question was a long canvas, some 4 yards at least, featuring the allegorical figure of Time being crowned by glory and honour. He turned his head, giving me just enough time to drop the salt into his wine.
"A Delacroix here? It would be unthinkable,"
he pronounced, turning back to me in some befuddlement.
"Delacroix is the greatest painter France has ever produced. It is impossible that such a vast canvas should not hang in the Louvre."
"Silly me, I am not a scholar of art," I told him with a modest air. "Now, we have a custom in the Alpenwald that the last of the wine must be drunk very quickly," I said, raising my own glass of Muscat. "It is a sort of tradition to ensure good health," I added quickly. I quaffed the last swallow of wine in one go, then raised my glass to him.
"A votre santé."
He downed the rest of the wine, shuddering.
"It was badly served. There was sediment,"
he told me seriously, smacking his lips. He paused a moment, then his expression turned to one of puzzlement, then outright concern.
"Madame,"
he murmured,
"you must excuse me."
He thrust back his chair, knocking squarely into the footman. I applied myself calmly to my pudding. Rupert pretended to brush a crumb off of his lapel, turning his face towards me.
"Did you just poison the French delegate to the Treaty of Windsor?"
he demanded. Not in the slightest, I replied. Salt is an emetic, not a poison. He groaned as he turned back to his dinner partner. I continued on with my pudding Saxe Weimar. After several minutes, the general returned, looking a little green about the face and dabbing perspiration from his temples. Feeling better, General? I asked brightly. He nodded, resuming his place. The footman presented a fresh dish of the pudding, but the general waved him off hastily.
A cup of tea, please, he pleaded. Very weak, nothing more.
The general spent the rest of the meal nursing his cup of tea and shuddering every time he looked at food. It was not the kindest method of handling the situation, I reflected, but it had always proven mightily effective. I glanced down the table to see Stoker still deeply engaged in conversation with Madame de Letellier. She laughed at something he said, exchanging his empty plate of pudding for her full one, and he attacked it with gusto. I gestured for the footman to fill my glass once more with the muscat the general had declined. But only halfway, I instructed. After the lavish amount of champagne I had consumed the previous night, I intended to keep a clear head about me for the signing of the treaty. When the last of the plates had been cleared, Rupert rose from his seat.
Your Serene Highness, my lords, ladies and gentlemen, he said, we have been invited to take our champagne in the lantern room.
Stoker sidled up behind me.
Did you have a nice dinner with Rupert?
He asked, grinning. I think your brother is rather put out with us, I told him. He shrugged.
Nothing that has not happened before.
I nodded towards his dinner companion, Madame de Letellier. Your partner is very pretty. His mouth twitched.
Enchantingly so, but she did not spend the meal leering into my gown. The general seems entirely taken with you.
Oh, he is. We mean to marry in the spring. We shall name our first child after you if it is a boy, or a girl. Revelstokia. He gave a snort of suppressed laughter behind his gloved hand. There was something utterly delicious about sharing a jest with him, a secret laugh that no one else in that company could understand.
Your Serene Highness.
The Chancellor's low voice interrupted my reverie. He gave me a tight smile.
You are doing very well,
he said, lowering his voice.
Not much longer.
We entered the lantern room. Above swung the lamp for which the chamber was named, an enormous lantern that cast a warm glow over the octagonal room. Across the expanse of thick carpet, a table had been laid with a white cloth, and enormous silver champagne coolers had been filled with ice. Dark green bottles were nestled in the snowy piles, rivulets of water running down the golden labels. Behind the table, footmen were discreetly opening bottles and filling coupes. Standing in front of the table was a diminutive figure dressed all in black. For a moment, my heart stilled in fear at the notion that it might be my grandmother. But this woman was too slender. Although her figure was lushly plump, it had not yet achieved the dumpling roundness of the Queen's. Her face bore traces of grief, marking a visage that had never been pretty, but might once have been handsome. It was a purposeful face, full of character, with a stubborn chin and a level blue gaze. Her gown was the latest Paris fashion, rendered in stark black silk and heavily embroidered in jet, which clacked when she moved. Dark hair, threaded with silver, had been pinned tightly back beneath a widow's peaked cap. A long black veil hung to her ankles, and at her neck a brooch of enormous diamonds shimmered and shattered the light. She held up her hands, more diamonds glittering as she moved. "Welcome, friends," she said in English, accented by an edge of German. "Welcome to Windsor Castle, where we take our first steps towards a lasting peace." She came towards me, hands outstretched. I recovered myself just in time to make her a low curtsy. "Your Serene Highness," she said, taking my hands in hers and lifting me. "Your Imperial Majesty," I returned in a low voice. She looked at me a long moment, studying me. Then her face wreathed in smiles. "We will not stand on ceremony, Gisela," she said, wrapping her arms about me. "Give me a kiss, child." There was no response to make except to return her embrace. I had recognized her at once from her photographs, of course. This was Her Imperial Majesty, the Dowager Empress of Germany, Princess Royal of Great Britain. And my Aunt Vicky. Chapter 25. The next several minutes were occupied with the handing out of champagne glasses and the greeting of the other dignitaries. Toasts were proposed and drunk, and through it all, I felt nothing but a blank calm I could not escape. I said the proper things and made the proper gestures, and yet I wanted only to run. The Chancellor crept close to me at one point.
"You said she was at Sandringham,"
I hissed at him through smiling teeth. He glanced at me in surprise.
"It was thought so, but she clearly wishes to celebrate her achievement in bringing this about. Do not distress yourself, my dear. You are doing perfectly well."
He moved away, and I realized he did not, could not possibly, understand the true source of my distress. He did not know of my relationship with the royal family, but Stoker and Rupert did, and between them they managed to keep close to me, one or the other always near at hand should I have need of them. The toasts were finished when the Empress rang a little bell. A footman appeared with a leather folio, presenting it to her with a flourish. Another small table had been draped with a cloth, and atop this were three pens, each resting in a narrow tray of mother-of-pearl. The Empress opened the portfolio and produced the copies of the treaty. It was a single page, shorter than I expected, but beautifully rendered with elegant copperplate and flourishes. At the top, it read, "Treaty of Windsor Castle, January 1889. A moment of history, I thought, as I gripped the pen tightly in my gloved hand. The general, entirely revived by the excellence of the champagne, beamed at me. He bent and scrawled his signature on the first copy as I put the pen to mine. I glanced at the Chancellor, who gave an almost imperceptible nod of the head. "Gisela, Frederica, Victoria, Helena." I had practiced the princess's signature until my fingers cramped, and the result was a triumph. There was a little stutter on the G, a hesitation as I held the pen poised over the paper, ready to commit forgery on an international and most likely felonious scale. But then I had taken a deep breath and pressed on, gaining confidence with each letter. As I signed, the general applied his own signature to his copy, a trifle unsteadily, shaking his head once or twice to clear the cobwebs, no doubt. It was done. We exchanged copies and countersigned. Then Rupert stepped forward to put his name as witness to the treaty. The general straightened and saluted me, wobbling only slightly.
I am your servant, your Serene Highness. It is my ardent hope that the bonds of our friendship will never be tested by the ambitions of the Kaiser. But if they are, you may rest assured that the Alpenwald will never know a truer ally than France.
He took a deep breath, summoning his composure, and bowed deeply, executing a perfect curtsy in my direction. Thank you, General, I said gravely. The Alpenwald is grateful for the friendship of France. Everyone applauded then, and fresh champagne was poured. As the glasses were passed, the door opened, and a plump gentleman in elegant evening dress entered. He glanced around the room.
Have I missed the party, then?
He asked, rubbing his hands together. I gripped the pen in my hand so tightly I heard it crack. A footman stepped forward, blushing for his tardiness at not announcing the newcomer as soon as he arrived.
His Royal Highness, the footman proclaimed, the Prince of Wales.
I had seen my father only twice before, and both times in passing. He advanced, smiling broadly and gesturing for a glass of champagne. I could not move or speak, but stood staring at him in mute. What? Horror? Longing? Resentment? There were no words for what I felt in that moment. I was unmoored, as adrift as I had ever been in my life, and a roaring sound rose in my ears, shutting out the sudden burst of excited conversation at the prince's appearance in the room. Suddenly, my arm was gripped hard just above the elbow.
Oh, dear, said the empress coolly. You seem to have spilt ink on your glove.
I glanced down to the ruined pen, still clutched in my nerveless fingers. I opened my palm to find pieces of it sitting in a pool of ebony ink on the ruined kidskin.
Come,
the Empress ordered, steering me by the arm.
We must wash your hands.
She guided me to the corner behind the champagne table, in the opposite direction from the prince. The Baroness started forward to help, but the Empress waved her off with an imperious gesture. I attempted to give the Baroness a reassuring smile, but my mouth would not curve. I forced myself to walk calmly with the Empress. In the corner there was only panelled wall, but she depressed a bit of moulding and a hidden door sprang open. She led me through, closing it behind us. We were in a narrow corridor, a hushed passageway, thickly carpeted and leading deeper into the castle. She did not speak as she moved, never hurrying but somehow covering the distance swiftly, as she led me down the passage and through another concealed door. We passed through a small octagonal dining room and into another corridor, up a small staircase, and finally into a lavatory, tiled in plain white and green, and surprisingly plain for all its modern conveniences. She closed the door firmly behind us, locking it. She turned, folding her hands together over the key.
Now, why don't you tell me who you are, and what you have done with Gisela?
Her eyes, brightly blue and slightly protuberant, were watchful. She came only to my chin, but a royal upbringing and lifetime spent in the strictest courts of Europe had honed her imperiousness to a fine edge.
I did not bother to lie. I would not have known how to begin. How did you know? I thought I was doing rather a good job of it. She did not smile, but the tightness of her lips eased.
I met Gisela last year at the baths at Friedrichsbad, where we both went to take the waters. We got to know one another quite well.
The Chancellor said you had never met.
The Chancellor knows only what Gisela wishes him to know,
she said with a knowing smile.
I presume he put you up to this. He, of all people, would know his princess from an impostor.
It was the Chancellor's idea, I admitted.
How much is he paying you?
Not a shilling, I told her. She raised an imperial brow.
Then why are you doing this?
For the sake of the treaty, I said. She regarded me a long moment, then shook her head.
You are a most remarkable person, miss.
She gave me an expectant look. Speedwell, I supplied. I had not expected her to know the name, but her eyes went wide.
Not Veronica Speedwell, Bertie's girl?
You know who I am?
Of course, she told me. I was newly married when all the business with your parents happened.
She waved a hand as if to brush aside the unpleasantness of my parents' marriage, my father's abandonment, and my mother's subsequent suicide.
Bertie, His Royal Highness, she corrected swiftly, and I have always been close. He wrote to me often in Berlin. I helped him with his troubles.
I did not much care for being characterized as one of his troubles, but there seemed little point in quibbling with her over the matter. She tipped her head, her gaze bright as a bird's as she looked me over.
You are very like Gisela. The resemblance is remarkable, in fact, but these things happen in families, and you both do share a connection some generations back. Little wonder the Chancellor thought to make use of you. But how did he come to meet you?
I was introduced to the Princess a few days ago. The Baroness von Wallenberg noted the resemblance, and when the Princess went missing, she suggested the impersonation to the Chancellor. Her gaze sharpened.
Gisela is missing?
Not precisely. She seems to have left of her own accord and means to return in due course. It is just that no one is certain of where she is.
So she is missing,
she replied tartly.
And Scotland Yard know nothing of this?
The Chancellor thought it best not to tell them. He was afraid that the Princess's absence might signal disrespect to the French, and the treaty might never be signed. She considered this a moment, then nodded.
He was right to worry. General de Letellier is a touchy sort of man, very conscious of French dignity, and easily offended. But how on earth did the Chancellor think he could get away with this ridiculous charade?
But he has, I pointed out. You are the only one who has detected the masquerade. The French have signed the treaty. The Chancellor has a secret document giving authority to me to sign on behalf of the Princess. I am dubious of the legality of the thing. No doubt I have broken a dozen international laws, but the Chancellor does not seem terribly worried about the prospect. She shrugged.
The Alpenwalders are acting in good faith, in as much as they are committed to aiding the French against my son.
Her mouth twisted a little on the last word. How thankless to be the mother of such a child. She seemed to intuit my thoughts, for she gave me a thin smile. You have never met your cousin, the Kaiser. Be grateful, child. There was no tactful answer to this, so I did not attempt one. Do you mean to unmask me? I asked, with more bravado than I felt. Her response was oblique. Do you know why I wanted this treaty, Miss Speedwell? Not simply to thwart my son. It was my husband's great ambition to bring Germany into the modern age. No more looking fondly backwards to the military parades and battlefield glories. He was a good man, the Emperor Friedrich. His father wanted nothing to do with his liberality, with his desire to bind Germany to the rest of Europe. My Friedrich waited all of his life to ascend the throne and remake his fatherland. By the time he became emperor, he was dying. There was no bitterness in her words, only resignation to the cruelties of fate. My poor Fritz was emperor for 3 months. For the whole of his short reign, they ignored him, those ministers and generals and Bismarck, she said, fairly spitting the name. They took one look at a dying man and knew his grip was too weak to hold power. They passed him over and went directly to the sun, praising him and promising to make his wildest dreams of German domination come true. This was the great mistake, you know. They think they can control him, can use him for their own ends. But no one can control my son, and they will learn this too late. My only hope is that it will not be too late for the rest of the world. She paused, fixing me with that austere blue stare. You are really doing this for the sake of the treaty? I am. Silence stretched between us, brittle, until she gave a sigh. Well, I have worked a year to bring it about. I am hardly going to take a hammer to it with my own hands, am I? She asked. Something within me, taut and painful, eased when she said those words. She inclined her head to my stained glove. Take that off. Carefully. You don't want to spot Gisela's gown. I peeled away the soiled glove as well as its spotless mate. I washed my hands carefully to remove all traces of the ink, taking my time. The soap was good, plain stuff, smelling faintly of lavender. There would be no cakes of finely milled French soap here, I reflected, only good, honest English soap, scented with lavender. The lavender is grown in the fields around Sandringham, in Norfolk, she told me as she played handmaiden, holding out a towel for me to dry my hands. It is his favourite house. Have you met him? She did not say my father's name. She did not have to. Never. Would you like to? Properly, I mean, and privately. It could be arranged. After all, I suppose I owe you something for what you have done tonight. I thought of that sharp twist of longing I had felt when I looked at him. Was it the call of blood to blood, or was it simply the childish wish to be recognized, to be owned by one's begetter? I imagined that brilliant, winsome smile turned upon me as I basked in its warmth, the kindly eyes crinkling as he looked at me. No, I told her. The Empress gave me a long look. Are you certain? I nodded, the jewels in my tiara clattering. She touched one. I never cared for tiaras with the gems en tremblant,
terribly noisy, I always think.
Impulsively, I put out a hand, laying it gently on her sleeve. Please, ma'am, I do not want to meet him at all. Not like this. She considered me a long moment.
Very well. Give me 10 minutes. I will make your excuses and say you are unwell. Your carriages and entourage will be waiting for you out front.
I thought of the suite at the Sudbury, yet to be searched. If you please, can you keep the others here as long as possible? I need only one carriage and the black-haired gentleman with the eye patch. Her gaze sharpened.
Is this to do with Gisela's disappearance?
In part, and another matter.
As you wish. 10 minutes. Find your way to the front of the castle, and I will have the fellow meet you there. I will keep the others as long as I can.
What will you tell them? Her thin smile was once more in evidence.
That is the advantage of being an empress, my dear. I do not have to tell them anything at all.
She turned to the looking glass and straightened the peak of her widow's cap.
I shall never be reconciled to this, she said with a dour look at it. Black does not suit me.
She gave me a last look over her shoulder.
Thank you, Veronica.
You are welcome, Your Imperial Majesty. Her smile was gentle.
My nieces and nephews all call me Aunt Vicky.
She left me then, my Aunt Vicky, the Dowager Empress of Germany. I took a breath, as deep as I could with the tight lacing of the corset, steadying myself against the wash basin. Before I could gather my thoughts, the door opened once more and J.J. Butterworth slipped inside.
You look like something the cat sicked up, she told me cheerfully. What an enchanting person you are, I replied.
She grinned, unrepentant.
Do not wait for me when you leave tonight, she instructed.
I blinked at her.
You mean to remain behind? At Windsor Castle?
She shrugged.
I have a story to chase. This was your plan in coming all along, was it not? You used us to gain entree to the castle because they would never permit a journalist inside if they knew who you were. What now? Rifling through the Queen's waste paper basket?
Her smile would have suited a cream-filled cat.
Something like that. Do not spare a thought for me, Veronica. I will have what I came for. And I promise not to involve you, she added, with an exasperated sigh. I know you are about to ask.
I flapped a hand.
I do not care. Just go.
She left in a whirl of aprons and indignation, but I scarcely noticed. She was hardly likely to burn the place down around everyone's ears, and I almost did not care if she did. Rage simmered within me, coupled with some other more painful emotion that threatened to flay me alive. I was in Windsor Castle, wearing a fortune in jewels, with my father a short distance away. The room was suddenly stifling. Gathering my skirts in my hands, I rushed out, down the tiny staircase and past the door I had entered. I was in a different part of the castle, and I passed through rooms I had not seen. One had walls bristling with weapons of every description, pikes and swords arranged in patterns, while another sported a gallery of paintings of men who had been instrumental in Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo. No one stopped me or stood in my way as I fled. I hastened from one vast chamber to another until I came at last to the vestibule where we had entered. The guards stood at attention as I passed, fleeing down the crimson carpeted stairs like Cinderella,
as the clock struck midnight.